Chapter 6. It was a glorious morning, late spring or early summer, as you care to take it, where the dainty sheen of grass and leaf is blushing to a deeper green, and the year seems like a fair young maid trembling with strange wakening pulses on the brink of womanhood. The quaint back streets of Kingston, where they came down to the water's edge, look quite picturesque in the flashing sunlight. The glinting river with its drifting barges, the wooded towpath, the trim-kept villas on the other side. Harris, in a red and orange blazer, grunting away at the sculls, the distant glimpses of the grey old palace of the Tudors, all made a sunny picture. So bright but calm, so full of life and yet so peaceful. That early in the day though it was, I felt myself being dreamily lulled off into a musing fit. I mused on Kingston. Great Caesar crossed the river there, and the Roman legions camped upon its sloping uplands. Caesar, like in later years Elizabeth, seems to have stopped everywhere. Only he was more respectable than good Queen Bess. He didn't put up at the public houses. She was nuts on public houses, was England's Virgin Queen. There's scarcely a pub of any attractions within 10 miles of London that she does not seem to have looked in at, or stopped at, or slept at, some time or other. I wonder now, supposing Harris, say, turned over a new leaf, and became a great and good man, and got to be Prime Minister, and died, if they would put up signs over the public houses that he had patronised. Harris had a glass of bitter in this house. Harris had 2 of Scotch cold here in the summer of 88. Harris was chucked from here in December 1886. No, there would be too many of them. It would be the houses that he had never entered that would become famous. Only house in South London that Harris never had a drink in. The people would flock to it to see what could have been the matter with it. At this point, Harris threw away the skulls, got up and left his seat, and sat on his back, and stuck his legs in the air. Montmorency howled and turned a somersault, and the top hamper jumped up and all the things came out. I was somewhat surprised, but I did not lose my temper. I said pleasantly enough, "Hello, what's that for?" "What's that for? Why..." "No. On second thoughts, I will not repeat what Harris said. I may have been to blame, I admitted, but nothing excuses violence of language and coarseness of expression, especially in a man who has been carefully brought up, as I know Harris has been. I was thinking of other things and forgot, as anyone might easily understand that I was steering, and the consequence was that we had got mixed up a good deal with the towpath. It was difficult to say for the moment which was us and which was the Middlesex bank of the river, but we found out after a while and separated ourselves. Harris, however, said that he'd done enough for a bit and proposed that I should take a turn. So, as we were in, I got out and took the tow line and ran the boat on past Hampton Court. What a dear old wall that is that runs along by the river there. I never pass it without feeling better for the sight of it. Such a mellow, bright, sweet old wall. What a charming picture it would make, with the lichen creeping here and the moss growing there, a shy young vine peeping over the top at this spot, to see what is going on upon the busy river, and the sober old ivy clustering a little further down. There are 50 shades and tints and hues in every 10 yards of that old wall. If I could only draw, and knew how to paint, I could make a lovely sketch of that old wall, I'm sure. I've often thought I should like to live at Hampton Court. It looks so peaceful and so quiet. And it is such a dear old place to ramble round in the early morning before many people are about. But there, I don't suppose I should really care for it when it came to actual practice. It would be so ghastly dull and depressing in the evening when your lamp cast uncanny shadows on the panelled walls and the echo of distant feet ran through the cold stone corridors and now drew nearer and now died away, and all was death-like silence save the beating of one's own heart. We are creatures of the sun, we men and women. We love the light and life. That is why we crowd into the towns and cities, and the country grows more and more deserted every year. In the sunlight, in the daytime, when nature is alive and busy all around us, we like the open hillsides and the deep woods well enough. But in the night, when our Mother Earth has gone to sleep and left us waking, oh, the world seems so lonesome. And we get frightened, like children in a silent house. Then we sit and sob, and long for the gaslit streets, and the sound of human voices, and the answering throb of human life. We feel so helpless, and so little in the great stillness, when the dark trees rustle in the night wind. There are so many ghosts about, and their silent sighs make us feel so sad. Let us gather together in the great cities, and light huge bonfires of million gas jets, and shout and sing together, and feel brave. Harris asked me if I've ever been in the maze at Hampton Court. He said he went in once to show somebody else the way. He'd studied it on a map, and it was so simple that it seemed foolish, hardly worth the tuppence charge for admission. Harris said he thought that map must have been got up as a practical joke, because it wasn't a bit like the real thing and only misleading. It was a country cousin that Harris took in. He said, "We'll just go in here so that you can say you've been, but it's very simple. It's absurd to call it a maze. You keep on taking the first turning to the right. We'll just walk round for 10 minutes and then go and get some lunch." They met some people soon after they'd got inside who said they'd been in there for 3/4 of an hour and had had about enough of it. Harris told them they could follow him if they liked. He was just going in and then should turn round and come out again. They said it was very kind of him and fell behind and followed. They picked up various other people who wanted to get it over as they went along, until they had absorbed all the persons in the maze. People who had given up all hopes of ever getting either in or out, or ever seeing their home and friends again, plucked up courage at the sight of Harris and his party and joined the procession, blessing him. Harris said he should judge there must have been 20 people following him, in all. And one woman with a baby, who'd been there all morning, insisted on taking his arm, for fear of losing him. Harris kept on turning to the right, but it seemed a long way, and his cousin said he supposed it was a very big maze. "Oh, one of the largest in Europe," said Harris. "Yes, it must be," replied the cousin, "because we've walked a good 2 miles already." Harris began to think it rather strange himself, but he held on until at last they passed the half of a penny bun on the ground that Harris's cousin swore he'd noticed there 7 minutes ago. Harris said, "Oh, impossible." But the woman with the baby said, "Not at all," as she herself had taken it from the child and thrown it down there just before she met Harris. She also added that she'd wish she'd never met Harris and expressed an opinion that he was an impostor. That made Harris mad, and he produced his map and explained his theory. "The map may be all right enough," said one of the party, "if you know whereabouts in it we are now." Harris didn't know, and suggested that the best thing to do would be to go back to the entrance and begin again. For the beginning again part of it, there was not much enthusiasm, but with regard to the advisability of going back to the entrance, there was complete agreement. And so they turned and trailed after Harris again in the opposite direction. About 10 minutes more passed, and then they found themselves in the centre. Harris thought at first of pretending that that was where he had been aiming for, but the crowd looked dangerous, and he decided to treat it as an accident. Anyway, they had got something to start from then. They did know where they were, and so the map was once more consulted, and the thing seemed simpler than ever, and off they started for the third time. And 3 minutes later, they were back in the centre again. After that, they simply couldn't get anywhere else. Whatever way they turned brought them back to the middle. It became so regular at length that some of the people stopped there and waited for the others to take a walk round and come back to them. Harris drew out the map again, after a while, but the sight of it only infuriated the mob, and they told him to go and curl his hair with it. Harris said that he couldn't help feeling that to a certain extent he had become unpopular. They all got crazy at last, and sang out for the keeper, and the man came and climbed up the ladder outside and shouted out directions to them. But all their heads were by this time in such a confused whirl that they were incapable of grasping anything, and so the man told them to stop where they were and he would come to them. They huddled together and waited, and he climbed down and came in. He was a young keeper, as luck would have it, and new to the business, and when he got in, he couldn't find them, and he wandered about trying to get to them, and then he got lost. They caught sight of him every now and then, rushing about the other side of the hedge, and he would see them, and rush to get to them, and they would wait there for about 5 minutes, and then he would reappear again in exactly the same spot, and ask them where they had been. They had to wait until one of the old keepers came back from his dinner before they got out. Harris said he thought it was a very fine maze, so far as he was a judge, and we agreed that we would try to get George to go into it on our way back.